Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. I'm always looking to help the Next Level Soul audience take their soul to the next level. And I've been able to partner with Mind Valley to present you guys with a ton of free masterclasses between 60 and 90 minutes covering mind, body, soul, relationships, and conscious entrepreneurship. Some of these masterclasses are taught by spiritual masters, relationship experts, best-selling authors, legends in the personal growth and spirituality space, and so much more. So if you want to sign up for any of our free mind, body, and soul masterclasses, just head over to nextlevelsoul.com/free. Disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of the show, its host, or any of the companies they represent. Now, we've had many near-death experiencers on the show before, but today we have Dr. Atwater, whose research into near-death experiences is profound, but specifically her area is childhood near-death experiences. And it's always kind of fascinated me on why children have near-death experiences, what the experiences are across the board, how they deal with it differently than adults, and so much more. It is a wonderful conversation and might be a little bit of a tearjerker, so prepare yourselves. This is an emotional episode. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. PMH Atwater. How are you doing, Dr. Atwater?
I'm doing great.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you. We had an adventure getting here to this point this morning, which is wonderful, but we're here now.
We are here now, and I am grateful.
So I'm very intrigued by your work, and you know, I've had a lot of near-death experiencers on the show, and it's one of the topics that really fascinates me, and again, so many different walks of life. But what I found really interesting about your work is your work with children and young people who've gone through NDEs, which we'll talk about a little bit. But before we get into all of that, how did you start working in the near-death experience space?
I died.
So you had your own NDE.
I died. I died three times in 3 months.
Oh, wow.
That's January 2, January 4, March. I think it was March 23, something like that. And then later that fall, I had three major relapses. How can I put it into words? I had to relearn how to crawl, how to stand, how to walk, how to tell the difference between left and right, how to see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all my belief systems. I was raped, became pregnant. It was because of difficulties with the pregnancy. The three deaths were, you know, it was from the miscarriage. And they were all long and complex. Each was different. Mm-hmm. And the third one, that voice spoke, had lots of you know, aspects to it, but mainly this voice spoke. I call it the voice like none other. It was not a guide, it was not a guardian, and it's not an archangel. It was none of that stuff. It was a voice so big, it's like the universe itself talking to me. And that voice said, test revelation. You are to do the research, one book for each death. Book one was not named. books 2 and 3 were named. Book 2 is Future Memory. If you haven't read that book yet, you need to do it, because it's not a book. It is a labyrinth. Every sentence, every paragraph, every page is part of the mathematics I was given and used to create the labyrinth. So therefore, you read through it like you would walk through a real labyrinth. You can't skip read, or, you know, you'll think I wrote a dumb book. In other words, you stay on the path. And the purpose of Future Memory, the book, is to bring your consciousness up to the next highest level possible for you at that time. And the third book was A Manual for Developing Humans. It's a fun book. Who of us are ever taught how to be a human being? I mean, when you go to the first grade, what do you learn? When you go to kindergarten, what do you learn? When you go to the sixth grade, what do you learn? Who teaches us how to be a human being? And, you know, several, maybe 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, I don't know how long ago, people used Hugh for the sign of God, for the voice of God. Hugh was God. Mm-hmm. Hugh. So Hugh man was God man, God woman. So it's literal. A Manual for Developing Humans is to help you to be the human being you are, that you were born to be a co-creator with the creator. I mean, that's who we are. That's what we are. That's what we're here for.
So let me
how to be a co-creator with the creator. And that book shows you how.
So let's go back for a second. So you said you had 3 near-death experiences. And when you went through those 3, what happened? Can you kind of guide us through a little bit of the first 3, well, all 3 of them, exactly what happened when you went to the other side and what you saw and so on?
Look, if you want an exact, we'll be here for hours.
Okay, so just give me the cliff notes.
Cliff note. Death number 1. I ran to the bathroom and I boarded on the toilet. Mm-hmm. And the pain was so bad that I rose up, I swear, into the heavens itself. And I was screaming at the heavens. And I heard my voice echo throughout the heavens itself. And when I looked down, this is the funny part. I saw my body all bloody on the floor. I'm a neatnik. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no way I'm going to own up to that body is my own, because it's all messy. But I kept bumping into the light bulb. And in my case, in my first one, the light was the light bulb. And I kept bumping into the light bulb, and I couldn't figure out why I was bumping into the bulb. And then there came like blobs. Like every thought I thought, that issued a blob in the air, like ink blots, and I couldn't figure out what they were, and I didn't like them. And so pretty soon I found myself jerked back into my body, literally jerked. You know, you got a rubber band and you're stretching out, and then you let go and wham. And I entered through the top of the head where your fontanelle is, you know, when you're a baby. And pulled back into my body, back to my toes. You're much bigger on the other side than you are on this side. So you have to squeeze to get back in. Well, I was still bleeding, and I couldn't figure out why. So I went to bed and stuffed myself with as many pillows and blankets as I could. And went back to sleep. I can always sleep. I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station. And They use the field outside of my window in Twin Falls, Idaho. We lived outside of town, and they use this that field as their gunnery range. And I never ever heard them. I never believed my dad that they were shooting guns out there because I never heard one. When I go to sleep, that's it, gone. So you know, that was not unusual for me at all. And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Then it finally occurred to me that maybe I ought to go to a doctor. Time, but I finally got the message. I have three children. I have two daughters, and they went on to school, and to the best of my ability, I got in my car, and it took me seemed like forever to drive like maybe 5 or 6 blocks to the doctor's office. And when I walked in the door, the head nurse was there. And she screamed. She said, I looked like that I had died. Mm-hmm. So she rushed me into the doctor, told him everything that happened. And all he did was laugh. He laughed at me. He said, here you are in this condition at your age. And all we do is laugh. Which wasn't very kind. So he gave me a shot in the right thigh vein. Which if he would have read my records, he would have known I couldn't take the shot, and sent me home. And it took me almost as long to get home as to get there. And the minute I walked in the door, the bleeding stopped. The hemorrhaging stopped. Like, you know, you turn a faucet and it's gone. But the pain began, especially the right leg. And I thought, well, I'm just going to go back to bed again. So I went back to bed again and instantly asleep. And didn't wake up till the next morning when my daughter was shaking me and saying, you know, should I call the office? You can't come back to work. And I said, yes, call them, tell them I can't come. My legs are lots and lots of pillows propped way high. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time I ever looked at my leg, right thigh. And it was crimson red. Mm-hmm. And there was a large bump growing out the side of my leg. And I just couldn't figure out what it was or what was going on. So I decided to call for help. We had a ranch style house. In those days, you didn't have, you know, what you have now. All we had was a wall phone in the kitchen. That's it, period, end of story. So I began to crawl from my bedroom through the living room, through the dining room, to get to the wall phone in the kitchen. And it took me forever to crawl because it was very, very painful. And I made it as far as the dining room. And I died. I died. And I floated up from my body. And lots and lots of things happened. Incredible things happen, being able to see thought, create things on the other side.
Were you met by somebody?
No, never was. The idea that you're always met by someone is false.
Okay.
Most people are met by someone, but not everybody. And in my cases, I was never met by anyone in all three.
So you never had a being, you never had a council of elders? Did you have life reviews or anything like that?
In this one, I did.
Okay.
I had a life review. I had an experience with creation. I had an experience with the void. And then I had the life review. And in my case, that life review included not only what I did, but the result of every thought I had ever thought on the environment, on other people, on the world at large, plus my just being in the earth world, the vibration of my being here, what the causality of that was with the air, with the water, with the ground, with the plants. So I had the whole gestalt of my ever having existed in the earth plane. And that to me was hell in the sense that nobody ever told me that every thought you think goes out and has a life of its own. Nobody ever taught me that. Nobody ever taught me that my vibration, just being in the world wherever I walked, changes the world or affects the world or has an effect on the rocks, the plants, you know, everything, the air. Nobody ever told me that. And that to me was a shock. And I was just looking at that and just, oh my goodness. And, you know, many, many things happened. Being very much in the void and realizing what the void was.
Which one was it?
You know, the idea that there's nothing in the void. There's absolutely, it's completely dark black. There's nothing there. But there is a vibration. It's very similar to when you're making Jell-O and you've just flopped the Jell-O out of the dish onto a plate. And just as you begin to touch that Jell-O on the plate, you're almost to the Jell-O. You're almost there. And there's this happening, this sense, this wiggle. And it's that wiggle that is responsible for creation.
Okay.
It's that sense of movement, but not movement, that all creation comes from. Yeah, you know, it was just fantastic.
When you came back from your near-death experience, is that when you started to, like, I have to start studying these and start interviewing other people who had these kind of experiences?
That was in my third one. In my third one, that was when I met the voice. That's when I was told to do this work. I was not told how to do it or how long it would take me. And the only way I could think of where I could do this kind of work, this research, was to use police investigative techniques, because that's what I knew. I was raised in a police station. I knew police investigative techniques. Now that's the techniques back in the 40s. And I knew those techniques. So when I was reasonably human, which took a year,
right.
Lots of things involved with that. What really helped me to discover who and what I really was in November, when I wasn't getting well, the doctor was concerned, and my friends were concerned. So they decided together that I should be taken up to Seattle, Washington, to the Mind Miraculous Symposium, and that would help me. And that's exactly what happened.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Can you believe a doctor would get up at 5:30 in the morning to give his patient a shot in the arm and lots of, you know, medicine so I could be trucked up? But that's what happened. And went to the Mind Miraculous Symposium, and the first speaker, Dr. William Tiller, physicist at Stanford. His talk was the eternal now. And he believed that everything was simultaneous, everything. And at the end of his talk, I can't remember any of his talk, but at the end of his talk, there was this great, huge, giant screen, maybe 5-6 stories tall. I mean, huge screen. And on that screen, he flashed up his drawing, his graph of what the eternal now looks like in physics. How you can draw that in physics. And it was the exact same thing I saw in my third near-death experience, exact.
Mm.
And I jumped up from that chair and ran out into the foyer and collapsed under a wall sconce. And I just cried and cried and cried. I'm not crazy. He saw it too. He knows about it. I'm not crazy. And from that moment on, I began to get well. I got well right away.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1978, I just walked out on my life. I did. On the very day I was to become a bank executive, you know, in those days, women didn't become bank executives, but on the very day that I could have a bank title, I quit my job. I walked into my boss's office on a Monday morning. I was supposed to have an appointment with my boss. I did. I was there, and I told my boss, sorry, but I'm quitting my job and I'm going to chase rainbows. And my boss went white. She said, sit down, don't say another word. My boss, very, very logical. Wow, logical. And at 4 o'clock that morning, she had been awakened by a very unusual dream when she went to her boss and said to him, I'm going to have to replace me because I was going to chase rainbows. That's not fair. You knew before I did. I didn't know till 9 that morning. She knew at 4 in the morning. So I sold my home, stored or sold everything I had. My children decided to go elsewhere. My son then was off taking a cruise school aboard a square rigger in the Atlantic Ocean, and decided to join the Coast Guard. My oldest daughter decided to be a drafter at a large architectural firm. My youngest daughter decided to leave and go live with her father. And so all of a sudden, they were gone. And then I was gone. And I went first to the Pacific Ocean to watch the sunset silver over the Pacific. And then I crossed the United States, fulfilling all my childhood dreams and wishes, wound up in the DC area watching the sun rise golden over the Atlantic. And that's when I began. And I began telling my story. Of course, in a police station. They had a very large police station, and one room was for the public. And so I told my story. And the frightful thing that happened to me was, after I was over, a woman came up to me with stars in her eyes, and she said, "Oh, I wish something would happen like that to me so I could do it too." And it's like, horror! I mean, did I do something to mislead her? Mm-hmm. Meditation or the other different ways that you can learn more about your own soul and spirituality. But she was thinking that she should die because I did. And it just so horrified me that I never talked about my own near-death experience again for decades.
But you were doing the work, but you were still doing research.
That's when I started to do the research.
So then let me ask you this, because I know you've interviewed, I think, over 7,000, I think, or something along those lines of people with near-death experiences. But tell me about... 5,000,
nearly 5,000 adults and children.
So tell me about your work with children, because there's not a lot of literature about other than yourself, about near-death experiences and children. Tell me about your work with children.
Well, of course, you know, I began with children many, 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 many years ago. And I found them very different, of course, in the way they talk about something like this. With a child, you're never above their eye level, ever, ever. You can't be. Or they feel that they must obey you. You have to be at their eye level so that you are a friend. So with little ones, of course, I spent a lot of time on the floor. Mm-hmm. And we would just talk. And I would just talk about their experience they had. And I'd go, "Tell me about it. Tell me about it." And then I would talk to the parents, "What's your child like now?" Yeah, before and after. That led to more and more meetings and opportunities with children, even those that had grown, maybe were in their 20s and 30s, that were talking about their experience as a child and what happened to them. And I wrote my first book about that, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. But then I got to thinking, you know, this isn't enough. This isn't good enough. There's something else here that I need to go much further and deeper with. And that was taking a better look, a deeper look at those that had the experience between birth and the age of 5. Because those children were different from any other children, even tweens and teens. So there's something going on here. So I devoted years more. Oh, how could I say this? I found that with those that had their experience between birth and the age of 5, they had nothing to compare anything with.
Right.
So there's not this idea of mom and dad and brothers and sisters and this kind of thing. I found very clearly that 90% did not bond with their parents. That doesn't mean they didn't love them. They just never bonded with them. the way they viewed the world was very different from any other kid.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
They knew more than their parents did. They knew more than their siblings did. They knew more than their teacher did. And so they had a lot of problems with attacks and criticism from other kids in school. That was a big issue with these youngsters. But there was just something really different about these kids. Mm. When I say that, I'm going to say, let's see, do I have some numbers here I can give you? I'd love to be able to give you well, let's see. I don't have it at hand right now, so
it's okay.
Yes, I do. Birth to 15 years. I changed that to birth just under six. These youngsters giving an IQ test when they were older, you know, when they were in school, they're giving the IQ test, 48%. Now that this is a specific study, 397 people, all bore, had that experience between birth and the age of five. So when they're a little bit older in school and they take the standard IQ test, they were scoring between 150 to 160. 48% were scoring between 150 to 160. This is genius. However, if they had, if it was birth to 15 months, if they had a dark light experience instead of bright light experience or a white light experience, they were scoring 190 and above. All of them. When you're talking about kids, you're talking about three lights. You're not talking about one. Mm-hmm. When the kids talk about light, there is this incredibly powerful, powerful, powerful light. Doesn't have any specific color at all, just really powerful light. And then there's this dark or black light, sometimes with purple tinges in it. And there's something about, there's something very loving and very wonderful and very nourishing about this black light. And then there's this white or bright light, sometimes with gold or silver in it, but this white light. And this is a light you can talk to. This is a light you can converse with. And I would ask these kids about, tell me more about these lights. And they said, well, that white light, that's father light. That black light, that's mother light. And that all-consuming, huge light, that's father. That's God's light. And the father light and the mother light, they come from God's light. Mm. And so they were very, very clear about this.
And multiple kids say things like this.
Yeah. Didn't matter where I was, in Canada or the United States or where I was. They were very clear about the differences between these three lights. And if you get the book, The Forever Angels, please, 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 everybody on the planet, get the book, The Forever Angels, because that's what takes you through my research of children between birth and the age of five. And you must read that, because these kids are not like any other kids. Their near-death experiences are not like any other near-death experience. They're different.
So what is a typical near-death experience, if I can say typical?
near-death experience for children, and depending, is it different for a 5-year-old versus a 1 or 2-year-old?
No, it isn't.
So what is a typical one?
Well, let me give you some of my cases.
Okay, please.
In this one case, this is Penny. And she's in utero. She's not born yet. Mm-hmm. And it's her mother smoking.
Oh, Jesus.
That bothers her so much. And she dreads her mother taking out a cigarette and smoking. And that alone, she felt like she was choking and she was dying. With another child, this one is Alma. Alma was about 2 years old. A family friend, a big male with a big tummy, would often come to visit the family. And when he would see her door open, he would go into her bedroom and shut the door, and he would rape her.
Oh, she's
a little 6-year-old. So you've got this big guy on top of her, and she can't breathe, and he's raping her, and she leaves her body, certainly in a near-death experience. She's up there on the ceiling. I want everybody to hear this. When a child leaves their body in fright or
trauma,
they want help. That's their way of saving their soul. That's their way of saving who they are. It is not an out-of-body trip. It is an emergency save. They're trying to save who they are. So this is what Alma did. She tried to save who she was, and she would take these out of body trips. Another one that you'll love, kind of like what I've talked about with lights. This is Star, and Star, when she was still hadn't been born yet, was still on the other side, and it was all black or dark. And she was there with other beings. She was choosing her life to come. And she was kind of, wondering, what if? And all of a sudden, she's pushed in. And she's stuck on the other side. So for her, that was very traumatic. It's like, oh, I didn't want to leave this perfect world, and I get shoved in. You get a lot of that kind of thing.
But that sounds more like a pre-birth memory as opposed to a near-death experience. Is that fair?
Kind of yes, and kind of no.
Okay.
When we're talking about pre-birth memory, what we're talking about is that stream of consciousness that seems to be, that we're all a part of. And the kids describe this as you come in, you take a dip, and then you go back out. And that's all a life is, it's a dip. And you're there on the other side. And for many of them, they don't want to take the dip. They get shoved or they get pushed, or for some reason, they're shoved in. And that's trauma. A lot of child experiencers, especially between birth and the age of 5, are very uncomfortable here. They don't like being here. And there's, let me give you a comparison here. 74% of these kids.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
They develop incredible mental abilities, artistic abilities, all kinds of abilities, and they go out and make a very good life for themselves. There were a number of them who became millionaires, a very rich and happy and good life. Yet, remember that 74%. 74% regretted being here and preferred to be on the other side, went through PTSD and wanted to die. It is not unusual with children who try to commit suicide. Not unusual at all. But let me give you an idea about this. For a child, for a small child, where they were was so filled with love. So much love, so much joy. And they were not breathing there. When they start breathing, that world is gone. So for a child, logic to a child is, if I stop my breathing, I can get back.
Sure.
So they stop their breathing to get back there. That's it. Yeah. That's it. That's the whole thing. A child doesn't realize that killing themselves is not necessarily a good deal, and it would hurt their parents, and you know, all of these problems could occur. So there's a whole chapter in the book PTSD with the NDE. 34%, now that's 397 experiencers, 34% were positive about their experience, 61% were negative about their experience.
Experience meaning the near-death experience.
Near-death experience.
So is that the white light, black light concept you were talking about?
All of them.
Okay.
And the reason for this upset was... they all simply wanted to go home. They felt a guilt for wanting to go back, a betrayal for getting kicked out. And, you know, it's dealing with this idea of, I still want to go back. This one woman who was 82, she was still longing to go back. And she's 82.
Yeah.
In the Forever Angels, in that book, it's based on people, children who have the near-death experiences as a child, and going forward, and they're looking forward, they're growing, maybe they're 21, 22, 25. Then I went after those people who were very, very mature, maybe 60, 70, 80. And if they could verify their near-death experience, and that 82 woman could because she had a sister that was 67 and remembered it. If they could verify their experience, I asked them one question, looking back. Did that near-death experience you had, did it make any difference in your life? And the results were just tremendous. It gives us the first and only study we have of the great round. That's the way Bruce Grayson put it. Of the great round, you see before and you see after coming back. The older person looking back, the younger child looking forward. You see the great round. And you realize that this idea of home, this idea of belonging, this idea of love is behind all of it. It's behind mm-hmm. all of it. Surviving and making life of yourself or regretting it and you know, maybe in regret for being here. It's all about home. And what I found is so simple to get rid of the whole thing, really, for most of them, when they're still a child, teach them how to take visualization classes. Teach them visualization. If they learn visualization techniques when they're a child, then they can go back there, stay a little while, come back here because this is where their job is. And that's all it takes. To be able to go back and relive it again or be with their friends and then come back here. And everything is fine with mom and dad and you know, and school. That's all it took. Visualization techniques. And, you know, I'm screaming as a researcher saying, wake up, world. You know, if we want to help our child experiencers, here is a powerful exercise we can use that will make all the difference in the world. Just, you know, incredible. And another thing, and now I'm going a little bit forward here, and I'm talking about abortion. And we need to talk about abortion. And I talk about it in the book. And you know, the woman's right to choose and all of this kind of thing. In my research, that one big major study, 397 people, the vast majority could remember their birth. One third could remember life in the womb. Two of them remembered conception. One of them, when she was older, drew a picture of it, gave it to her parents, and they were so embarrassed. She was absolutely right. All the positions, everything, she got it all. There's more going on here than what we prefer to look at. And in my own family, I have two daughters, a son, and one of my daughters got pregnant out of, you know, she wasn't married, got pregnant, didn't want the child. It was far too early in her life. Mm-hmm. And she came to me and said, Mom, what do I do? And I said, my dear, it's not the woman's right to choose. It's the soul. You must go to the soul and talk this over with the soul. You're dealing with a soul here, not just a bunch of cells. You're dealing with a soul of a human being. So she did. She went and she prayed. She got into deep meditation and she prayed. And the little soul was a boy, little boy. And she explained to this little boy that she really wasn't ready at all. And would he please leave? And he said, sure. You know, no problem. I'm happy to leave. I'll go somewhere else and find another mother. So she got her abortion. She felt good. The family felt good. Everybody felt good about it. If that child had said, yes, I want to come with you, then that means there's something special to learn between the two of them. So when I hear all this news now today about the woman's right to choose, I'm saying to myself, it's the soul's right to choose. Get in touch with the soul of that child. Find out what the child wants.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So let me ask you, with all the research that you've done with children, were there any unpleasant or hell-like experiences that they went through?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So can you talk a little bit about what that is? Because it means I understand an older person who's been around a little bit that might go through a hellish experience because they're dealing with stuff that they're dealing with and so on and so forth. But a child, it's interesting. So please let me know, what did you find?
Well, in my research base, broadly, one out of seven in my research with adults and children, one out of seven had a hellish or unpleasant experience. You know, we have to say unpleasant because not all of them are really hellish. With a child, this one child saw kind of like black beings with pointed fingers, and they were after her. It was a little girl. They were after her. And she was screamed her way out of the experience. I had another case where we wouldn't necessarily call it hellish, but it was to her. There was this big stage, and on that stage, she was acting out or saw elements in her life where she was attacking or having problems with her sisters, and she was attacking her sisters. And to her, that was just awful, 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 because she could see how her attacks against her sisters were wrong. She shouldn't be doing that. And she came back so horrified that she had done that, that it just caused her a lot of difficulty until she got older and could then begin to realize that this was not just a warning, but, you know, a helpful way of her to see her behavior and the effect it had on others. So that was another one.
Now, because I've heard other near-death experience stories that are hellish-like or unpleasant, but then it turns into a positive, meaning a being of light comes and, you know, takes them away, or it turns into something positive. They just have to kind of go through that first in order to get to the positive. Was that the case in children, or was it hellish and then they came back?
It was the case with children too.
Okay.
Most of them came back and then dealt with it and began to learn, you know, what it meant for them, what they could do about that.
But there was a pop, but they did go to a positive place before they came back, or did they come back from
you know, it's like that little girl and all these
horrible
fingers and nails at her. She came back with that still very real.
Oh, okay.
You know, in her life, she did not at all deal with that on the other side. No, she had to deal with it on this side. So you get all of these different types. You know, there are clearly four types of near-death experiences.
Please tell me.
They're what I call the initial, where maybe it's just a brief out-of-body experience, or the loving nothingness, or there's a friendly voice and that's all there is to it. There's the unpleasant or hellish experience. I think we know about that one. We have the pleasant or heavenly experience. Over 50% have that. I had 48% had the heavenly, and then there's the ascendant experience. With the ascendant experience, it almost never ever talks about the family or anything to do with the family or the person as an individual. You'll get your past life experiences with the unpleasant or the pleasant, but you don't get it with a transcendent. Let me give you an example of a transcendent experience. And this is Ricky Bradshaw. His case was horrendous. And when he was in an iron lung fighting to come back, he was shown all of history from beginning to end. He was told that he could never talk about the future. He could only talk about the past and now. Ricky Bradshaw became one of the most incredible cases in history. He was ground in half. Actually, he was a bag boy at a grocery store. It was like 2021, getting money for college. And these two cars were in front of the grocery store. And there were older ladies, and he was bending over to put the bag of groceries into the trunk of a car when the woman behind him somehow, for some reason, had problems with the gas pedal or something, and she suddenly lunged her car. Lunged forward, and the woman in the car in front then lunged backward, and Ricky was caught in the middle. He fell, so that the two fenders ground him in half at the mid-level. The only thing left attached was the spinal cord. That's it. Of course, the police came, the ambulance came, he was rushed to the hospital. There's nothing they could do about him. So they just, put him to one side. Well, fortunately for Ricky, this happened to be a teaching hospital. And so here's some would-be doctors that are down there, and they go to the head and they say, "Do you have any cadavers around here that we can play with?" He said, "Yeah, you can have this guy over here." And that was Ricky. So they put him in another room, hooked him all up. And, we're doing the pretend doctor thing. And all of a sudden, the machine began to register heartbeat. Well, the would-be doctors thought there was something wrong with the machine.
How long was he dead?
Long enough for to be rushed to the hospital, put in the attending room, hooked up by these would-be doctors.
Gotcha.
And then for them to run and find a real doctor and bring him back and show him the machinery and saying, there's something wrong with this machine. It's showing a heartbeat. And the doctor screamed and said, "He's really coming back." And so the real doctor took over. And then we have the case of Ricky Bradshaw.
So what happened to Ricky on the other side? He sounds like a fascinating case.
Oh, my. Oh, my. lots and lots more than I could ever tell you.
Can you give me some good highlights? I mean, besides the, I saw the entire history of humanity thing. That's a pretty big one.
One of the things that Ricky had to deal with was his lungs wouldn't work. So he's put in an iron lung.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And he was in this room. Nobody else was there. And the light kept flicking on and off, and the iron lung kept flicking on and off, and he's panicking. What do I do? What do I do? He prayed and prayed and prayed. Nobody told him, well, of course, they wouldn't tell him, that one of the average after effects of a near-death experience is electrical sensitivity. He was doing that himself. You know, in my office right here is all set up to handle my energy. Otherwise, I couldn't do a Zoom show with you. Mm. I mean, no way. I couldn't handle a keyboard. I can't handle an iPhone or, you know, cell phone and all that. I mean, my husband could do that, but I can't. Mm-hmm. Because they might be. I brought down the power of many a building or certainly part of the building where I was because of my own electrical sensitivity. So Ricky's
seeing the eyes. The lights going back and forth. So what happened?
Well, he then began slowly but surely to catch on to the fact that maybe he can handle this through prayer. And he did.
Dr. Atwater, this is a fascinating conversation. Your research is pretty remarkable in regards to children and the genius thing is pretty remarkable. And, you know, they're so closely connected to the other side. I've heard so many times people saying that children, when they're younger, they're pure joy because they're connected to the other side. And as they're conditioned or trained in being a human, they start to slowly get that goes away and they become more what we are and a day-to-day basis. But the fascination is of them dying, coming back at a very young age, at 5-year-olds and all the commonalities you have. How many children did you interview over the years?
Well, I can't really give you a number because my research base is nearly 5,000 adults and children. That one major study I did was 397. But, you know, there's lots of kids besides that. Mm-hmm. But again, this idea that we really, really need to take a second look at kids. When they're older, fine. But when they're young, we really need to look at that. Mm. It's not what we think. You know, we human beings love a good story. You know, we love all the angels and all this wonderful and beautiful things children are saying. Okay, who goes back to that kid 8 years later, 13 years later, 27 years later? Look, friend. It takes, for the average near-death experiencer, it takes 7 to 10 years to integrate the experience. Mm-hmm. For the average child experiencer, it takes 20 to 40 years.
Wow.
A child does not integrate, a child compensates. So you're looking at a whole different package. Because a child, as they're growing up, they'll do everything they can to mind mom and dad, or, you know, get along in school, do what their teachers do. And they, when they get older, do what the crowd does. Let me give you an example right now. About 3 months ago, I received a phone call. It was from a cop on the beat in New York City. He was in his late 40s. He was crying. He just got a hold of the book, The Forever Angels, and read it. He said, for the first time in my life, I know I'm normal. This is a big one with kids. Children do not integrate their experience. They compensate. And that's exactly what the cop did.
That's fascinating.
We need to take another look at kids.
Well, Dr. Atwater, I'm going to have a few, I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all of my guests. What is your definition of living a good life?
Laughter. Laughter and joy. No matter what I am doing, no matter where I am. Even if I'm pissed. Laughter and joy.
How do you define God?
All that is.
And what is the ultimate purpose of life?
It'll be different for different people. But if we're going to look at it as you are attempting to, I would say we're here to learn.
And where can people find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
www.pmhatwater.com. I produce a free monthly newsletter. Get on that website. Go over to newsletter. Fill out the form. You're in. It's free. It's monthly. There's an archive. You can go through the archive and see previous issues. I warn everybody, my newsletter is for the curious. And if you're not curious, you won't like my newsletter.
And of course, they can get your books on Amazon.
Yes.
Dr. Atwater.
And on my website, too.
Dr. Atwater, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your research and your journey and your experiences with everybody here. So I appreciate you, my dear. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you, too. Bye-bye.
I want to thank Dr. Atwater so much for coming on the show and sharing all of her knowledge and experience with all of us. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/156. And if you've only been listening to this over podcast and you want to watch these amazing conversations, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at nextlevelsoul.com/YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, trust the journey. It is here to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.